Okay, so welcome everyone. We are on 6A, Vavam and Aleph. Again, thanks so much for the accommodations last week. Let me turn off my WhatsApp web because we don't need to hear that pinging in the background every time something on the co-ed town crier goes off, you know? Apparently there's all these machloksim and discussions that take place in there that I usually mute it from time to time. But anyway, now it's off, so no more distractions. I'm not sure what was going on tonight. Anyway, I can see everyone shaking their heads over there for those who know what I'm talking about. So thanks to everyone for making the accommodation for Wednesday last week. And if anyone wasn't able to join, because I understand it wasn't at our regular time, we record all these classes. You guys are being recorded right now, if that's not clear in the top left corner. And the idea is it goes up just on YE Torah, it goes up on YouTube, that way we could share it with everyone. All right. So Vavam and Aleph, we're on 6A. 6A, I believe, to the first power. And now you might be looking at this Amud of Gemara over here and saying, oh, it's such like a short little piece over here tonight. It's going to be so easy. It's going to fly by so fast. And, you know, basic shot in the Gemara, it actually will go, I think, relatively smoothly. I don't want to scare anybody off. But a telltale sign that there's a lot to say about a particular Amud of Gemara is if the commentary to Gemara ratio is more commentary than Gemara itself, taking up space on the page. So, right, for instance, if you look at Hey Amud Beis, the Gemara dominates the page over there. Over here is a little bit of Gemara, and Tosfos goes crazy on the Amud over here, the commentary on the left. And we're actually, I think, if we have enough time, we might actually read at least one of the Tosfosim inside. And, well, they're actually, interestingly enough, Art Scroll started working on a translation of Tosafos. So for those who are learning Gemara for the first time, just to familiarize ourselves, we got Rashi on the right, who's like Rashi in the Torah, the basic commentary. But you have the Baalei Tosafos on the left, who also were a medieval commentary. They actually, some of them are relatives of Rashi, and they will critique Rashi much of the time, and they'll ask really great questions on the Gemara and provide really great answers that are disputable. So we might actually take a look at Tosos tonight because we will probably need to do so just to understand basic pshat, our basic understanding of the Gemara. So if you remember last time, we left off with the Mishnah on Hey Amud Beis on the bottom. And what I want to do is I don't want to review the entire Mishnah like we usually do, but really what we just need to know is the end of Hey Amud Beis. So on the bottom of Hey Amud Beis, and I guess those who are in for the sermon on Shabbos, you know, our Gemara crew got I gave her, the whole crew a shout out because I actually referenced this Mishnah in my sermon this past Shabbos. So remember how I was joking at the end of the Mishnah, it sounds like a good Shabbos morning sermon, and I was like being all condescending about it? Well, it turns out, you know, I was actually that guy who used it in the Shabbos morning sermon. So I'm not always being facetious when I say that, apparently. So what was the end of the Mishnah? Just so you remember what we were talking about. So if you could glance at the bottom of 5b on Hey Amud Beis, so the Mishnah noticed that in the verse it said, Apishnaim Eidim Oshlosha Eidim Yakum Davar. Or Yumas HaMeis. What was the actual quote? Yumas HaMeis. So the question was, why does the Pasuk tell me that three witnesses are accepted in court when I know already that two witnesses are admissible proof in court? Kal v'chomer, certainly three. And the Mishnah offers four different interpretations of what this superfluous three witnesses in the verse is coming to teach me. So if you look on the second to last line in the Mishnah, we get one more explanation. Umashnaim nitsa echmehen karov o pasul edusim betela. Avshlosha nitsa echmehen karov o pasul edusim betela. So just as two witnesses, should one of them be an invalid witness, you need two witnesses, right? So if one of them is a pasul, it's an illegitimate witness, then the other guy is useless. He can't testify now. The entire avis, the entire testimony loses its credibility. So too, if you have a kat, a group with three witnesses, and one of them is found to be has a psul, for instance, is a relative to one of the litigants, then the entire group, the entire kat, is invalidated, they lose their credibility in Beeston. And so that's why we mentioned three in the verse to teach us. So you have three people, two of them are not relatives, but one of them is a relative to the people who are the Bali Din, the members, the litigants in this case. These witnesses, their testimony is discarded.
Question.
Oh, already. Okay.
Is it a matter of loss of credibility or a matter of loss of capacity to testify?
Probably the I would say the latter is probably more accurate. I appreciate Zadie picking up on that. Right. It's not necessarily that the rest of the group lose their credibility, even though I could think to explain it in that way. But definitely from a very functional level, it's simply the entire cot is invalidated. So is it because they lose credibility by virtue of association? One could posit that, but not necessarily. There's definitely no mention here in the Mishnah of that. So that's right. It says a dusan betela. It doesn't say that they're not neman. It says a dusan betela. Their testimony just fizzles away. It dissipates. Okay. How do we know even if you have 100 people in the same cot, one of them is invalid, everyone's testimony gets discarded? That's why it says the extra word of Edom. Now, when does this rule apply? So that's a machlokus. Now we're on the top of Vav Amud Aleph, we're on the top of 6a. Amar Rav Yossi, Bamed Dvarim Amurim. Bedini nefashos, avo bedini mamnos, tiskayma edus bishar. When do we have such a high standard that we need to hold the witnesses to such a high standard that if one of them is invalidated, everyone's invalidated, we discard the entire testimony? That's only when it comes to capital cases. And so this speaks a little bit to the point before, Zadie, that is this a matter of them losing their credibility? And I would say maybe yes. Maybe the idea is that if we already have reason to doubt the legitimacy and the credibility of one member of that group, then we have reason to doubt the credibility of the other two members of that group. And now usually we wouldn't do that, Rabbi Yossi says. But when it comes to the capital cases, we need to be so certain beyond the shadow of a doubt that this person committed whatever act it is that incurs capital punishment, that if one of the witnesses is an invalid witness, it casts a shadow of doubt on the rest of his group that came in with him, which it's not unreasonable. You know, you come in with a guy who's not a valid witness, we got to ask, why are you keeping company of someone who's an invalid witness? So that's number one. That's one opinion. But when it comes to dine mumnus, when it comes to monetary cases, the bar isn't set as high. When it comes to a typical pedestrian monetary case, if one witness is not valid, but the other two are valid, you know what? We're not going to discard their testimony out the window. No reason to do that. So they happen to have gotten a group together with a guy who's puzzled. So that's actually the standard. But the exception to the rule is capital punishment, where the entire cot just disappears. Okay, that's opinion number one. Opinion number two, which we are concerned for, and we're going to talk about when it comes to witnesses for weddings. We'll discuss that tonight. Rebbe argues, Echad dine mamnos, echad dine nefashos. No, the same principle, the same standard, that if one guy goes, the entire testimony goes. Everyone's invalidated. That applies not just to your every, once in a while capital case, but it applies to your typical dine mamnos. You have a dispute over a real estate. You have a dispute over a loan. The same rule applies there. One witness is invalidated. All of them are invalidated. The Amasai, but however, even though he applies this rule in a much more far-reaching fashion, that one goes, they all go, he says, though, there's a limitation. You see, how do we define a cot of witnesses? We asked this question. A number of us brought this up a few times already. What makes people into one group? A group of 100, a group of 3. How do we get these numbers? Where do we draw the line between them? So we begin to explain this in the Mishnah, and the Gemara will elaborate on it. Rebbe says, "Ve'emasai bizman shahasru behen How do we know that they intended to be part of the same group where they gave hasra together? So if you have if you have three witnesses, and these three witnesses gave hasra, they gave the warning to the guy saying, you better not kill him, otherwise you'll incur capital punishment, then it's very clear that if they're giving hasra together, they're warning him together, they intend to be part of the same group that's going to testify in court against him later on. Because think about it. If we didn't have this principle, if everybody who sees the crime done is automatically part of the same group, what happens if, God forbid, one brother sees his brother be murdered, and then there's a lot of witnesses who see it? It's in broad daylight in Times Square. So you're going to say what? Because his relative had to see him murder, we're going to add insult to injury, and he can't even, now he invalidated everyone else from testifying in that case? That's too far. That's absurd. Rather, how do we determine if two people are part of the same cot if they gave a warning together? Then it shows that they intended to work together as well, and that's what makes them part of the same group, according to Rebbe. So those are the two opinions in the Mishnah. On the one hand, the first opinion, Rabbi Yossi, is more lenient, I don't know if lenient is the right term over here, but he says that this whole rule of invalidating the entire cot is limited to capital cases. Rabbi says, no, we expand it even to average Joe Dine Mumnus cases, but with the qualification that what makes a group one group, they have to give Hasrat together. They have to give the warning together. Okay. That is the machlokus in the Mishnah. I'll pause over here so we can clarify that in case we're getting a little dizzy already. Any questions that we could do to clarify this machlokus? Okay. So, all right. I hope that is clear then. Great. So let's move on. So now the Gemara is going to ask a question. So you see, according to the second opinion of the Mishnah, according to Rebbe, we know how witnesses become part of the same group. How to become part of the same group? If they give hasra together, if they give the warning together, they do something to display their intention to be part of one group. But according to Rabbi Yossi, we don't really know how a group of people coalesce and become one cot in Beis Din. You see, what makes, let's say, four people testify the same testimony in Beis Din, what makes them a group of four versus two groups of two, right? Rav Yossi hasn't given us any criteria to work with. So the Gemara comes to explain that. Amar Rava, Vahu Shehidu Kulam Besoch De Dibor. So in the way we join witnesses together is if they testify Toch Kide Dibor of each other. Now, Toch Kide Dibor, that's a good term. If you're taking notes on terms, this is one you want to remember. This is a concept that spans all across Shas. Tokadei Dibor is basically a few seconds. It's essentially like a halakhic unit of time. We're going to see in the Gemara in a moment, Tokadei Dibor is essentially the amount of time it takes. Let's say my Rebbe comes over to me and I say, Shalom Alecha Rebbe. You know, I say, Shalom Aleichem Rebbe. The amount of time it takes me to say hi to him is called Tokadei Dibor. You see, because if I was involved in a business transaction, you and I, you know, I was doing Mechiras Chametz, let's say. I'm selling the Chametz to Chris. And I'm in the middle of stipulating the terms of this sale. And then all of a sudden, let's say my Rebbe Rev Tendler walks in. So I'm expected to have to stand up and say, Shalom Aleichem Rebbe, and acknowledge him and greet him. And then I get to go back to my business proceedings. So the thing is, though, that if I pause in the middle of my business proceedings, you can say, oh, he ended the thought. His line of stipulation ended right there. So that's not how it works. If you take a few second break and say, Shalom Aleichem Rebbe, that's not considered a pause for halakhic purposes. And this is an important idea in general. You know, you're davening, you accidentally say the wrong word, you have tokadei dibor to go back and correct yourself. It comes up in many, many areas of halakha, not just here. So tokadei dibor, that's a very important concept that we want to know.
In the midst of the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Tokadei dibor, exactly. And it's really just a few seconds. So now, what is the issue? So what's Tokhti Dibor over here? So Rava says, they all testify within Tokhti Dibor of each other. So right now, the Gemara assumes is that they managed to get in all their testimony literally within a few seconds of Tokhti Dibor. Now, I can see some of you, right? I see Jenny's like, how the heck is this supposed to work over here? Well, thank God, you know, you're mechaving to the Gemara. The Gemara has the same question. Amar alei Rav Achmi difti l'Rabina michti Tokhti Dibor heichi da mikdei she'as tamid l'Rav. What is the amount of time for Tokhti Dibor? Now, the time it takes for a student to greet his teacher. Mea tuvahavu. So what? How do we get 100 men to give their testimony within the span of a few seconds? That's absurd, you know. That's even if you're like the guy leading Shachris at Ashkama Minyan, you can't go that fast. Which is we have a few Ashkama Minyan people over here, so you guys know what I'm talking about, right? Like it's like you know, when we do long tachlin on Monday and Thursday, you know, even those people who actually finish it on time, getting all the words in, you know, they can't do it in this amount of time. So
the classic to talk of the viewers actually diving, like if the chazan forgets Mashi Varuach or Amelech HaKadosh, whatever, and remembers Betol Kedei Dibor, they don't have to go back to the beginning.
Right. So that's the whole idea. Now, there are a few things Tol Kedei Dibor it doesn't apply to. Like if you blaspheme God forbid, you don't get Tol Kedei Dibor.
Right.
You know, you don't get to make amends on that. But you're right. Most of Kol Torah Kula, except for a few exceptions, you can go back on a stipulation. You could go back if you accidentally said, like you said, for Mashiv Ruach, you said the wrong word at the wrong time. You have Tol Kedei Dibor to go back and amend that. So it's everywhere. It's everywhere, and it's a Shas concept, as they call it. Very important to know. Now, okay. So the question is, how do we get all their testimony and Tokhti Dibor of each other? Marle, this is actually what I thought when I first read it, but I guess the Gemara needs to clarify it for all of us. Marle, kol chad v'chad b'tokhti dibor shel chaver. How does it work? If each person gives testimony within Tokhti Dibor of the next guy, they're considered one cut. So I come in, I'm Reuven, and I say, I saw Levi kill Shimon, blah, 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 blah. And then right afterwards, we bring up the next witness, Tokhti Dibor. He gives his testimony as well. And then the next guy also comes, and we put him up to the stand within Tokhti Dibor. We say, you begin your testimony. It's actually a good method when you think about it, because you don't give the witnesses any time to try to think of how they're going to fit exactly into what the first guy said. They have to actually say what they plan to begin with. So you don't give them any time to formulate a different testimony. So that's the idea of Tokhti Dibor. Then that puts them into one con. But 10 minutes later, other witnesses come into Beis Din. They become a second group of witnesses. Okay. So that
Rabbi, I have a question. Just I'm trying to understand the process. And you know, I guess I always kind of do this, you know, in the judicial system here in the United States, you get a witness, the witness is, you know, gives direct testimony based on direct questioning from one of the lawyers or the judge. And then there's cross-examination to kind of probe whether, you know, there are holes in the testimony, that sort of thing. In this example, with the Toch Chedei Dibor, it sounds like a witness comes in, their piece, they leave, the next witness comes in and says their piece. Is there any process there by which they're cross-examined or questioned, or is it just they're giving their story and that's it?
So my understanding of it is that the Drisha V'Chakira, which is called in Hebrew, is the cross-examination. They'll generally do one, I think, as a preliminary measure, if I'm not mistaken. But once they're giving their testimony in Beis Din, we would have them testify within, you know, a few seconds of each other. And then they give over that testimony. So the Drisha V'Chakira, I think, is actually done as a preliminary measure. Toby. You're muted.
This particular piece of Gemara that we're doing right now, does this only apply to Adim Zomamin, or this applies to witnesses in general?
This applies to witnesses in general, actually. Mm-hmm. This Gemara, you see, there, right, exactly. That, I appreciate you bringing it up, because what we're going to talk about, actually, we're going to do soon, is talk about witnesses at a chuppah, at a wedding. And so the principles we're learning today in this Gemara pretty much are not, none of this is exclusive to Adam Zomen, actually. Mm-hmm. We got into this by way of talking of Adam Zomen, but tonight's Gemara really is about testimony and witnesses in general. So that's good. I appreciate you bringing out that point, Toby. Okay, let's go into the next piece of Gemara. Now, the next piece of Gemara is going to focus on the first opinion, the Mishnah of Rab Yossi. So Amar Le, Sarekiv Amar, Loba Shlishi, etc., Mashnaim, etc. Here goes the Gemara. Amar Le Rab Papa Le Abaye. Elem Yata Harug Yatzil. So here's the thing. See, according to the second opinion of the Mishnah, according to Rebbe, what makes someone part of your group of witnesses? If they give hasra, if they warn with you. According to Rav Yossi, whoever's there at the scene of the crime and sees that crime committed, automatically they become one cut to the extent that they could invalidate each other. So here is the issue. Here's the issue that's going to come up. You see, the person who's being murdered, he's a valid witness, right? So he says, let me add Tahara Gyatzil. Maybe when Reuven kills Shimon and Shimon gets stabbed by Reuven, well, Shimon is a valid witness. But the issue is that Shimon, is a Karov Eitzel Atzmo. He can't testify, or Sone rather. So because he naturally, I believe he would despise the person who's murdering him, he is he wouldn't serve as a valid witness against him in Beis Din, since you can't get more biased than that. You hate the guy who's murdering you, I would think so. So the issue is, according to Rav Yossi, shouldn't he be combining with the other witnesses to invalidate them? So Abaye answers, Kishahar Gumeacharav. So the case has to be, you know what? There's only legitimate testimony when he's stabbed in the back. That way he couldn't have been a valid witness, since he couldn't have been a witness at all, since he didn't witness himself getting killed. But then he says, okay, I'm getting good reactions over here. The Gemara is going to say this as well. So in that case, a similar issue would come up. Nirba Yatzil, a man who's being sodomized by another man, shouldn't he also be able to save meaning he's saving the person who's sodomizing him because he's witnessing that being done. And therefore, since he's now grouped together with all the witnesses who saw it get done, he would invalidate everybody because he can't testify against the person who is sodomizing him. So the answer is no, kisharavu me'achorav. It was when it was done from behind and he wasn't able to see it being done to him. But then here's the thing though. I'll one-up you right now. Forget about the victim. Horeg v'roveya yatzilu. Wait a minute. Wouldn't the murderer and the sodomizer, both of them witnessed what they did, of course. So shouldn't they automatically be grouped together with the rest of the witnesses? And thereby, since they can't testify against themselves, because we have a principle, eino demesim es atzmo rasha, a person can't self-incriminate himself in Beis Din. So if that's true, then because he saw himself commit the sin, by that logic, he should invalidate everybody else as well, because he'll join with them and he'll be an invalid witness against himself. And then he disqualifies everyone else along with him. So essentially what the Gemara is saying is it's a reductio ad absurdum. This kind of logic leads to an absurd conclusion that's untenable.
Therefore, Rabbi, based in a person can't confess?
Based in, so if I come into Beis Din and I say I murdered somebody and I testify along with somebody else, that would not be a valid testimony because we have principle ain't other Mason Satsu Russia that a person cannot self-incriminate himself.
Well, let's say there was no second witness. What if he just comes in and says, I killed Joe Schmo? We just let him walk?
Yeah.
So the best thing to do is just go in and confess.
Best thing, right? So what some people, there's a similar case where you know how we talk about killing Bishogeg, killing accidentally. We're going to talk about it in the second chapter. So if you kill someone inadvertently, you get put into Gullus, you got put into exile.
You're Mikloth, yeah.
Right. So what someone might want to do is they'll say, no, I killed him deliberately. And since he didn't have all the conditions of witnesses,
giving
Masra and all that, so then he could walk. And that's why we talked about last time. I think we talked about in Sechet Sanhedrin, the Kippah, how people who are a menace to society and they get off on a technicality, Beis Din has, I don't know if you call it extrajudicial, but it's definitely within their purview. But they have like this extra halachic recourse to incarcerate him. I remember talking about this in a class recently. I'm not sure which one I was talking about it in, but I think Toby, you were in it. So I'm not, you're in most of the classes. So,
oh, well,
so that doesn't help.
My memory's like,
okay. But anyway, this question is such a good question that Ishtik, Abai, did not have a response. All right. So, you know, we were all raising our eyebrows saying, this is pretty absurd. Abai said, you know what? You backed me into a corner here. I don't have a good response. So therefore, he also like I made the Rava, but when this question was brought before his adversary, his Bar Plukta, Rava, not adversary in a bad way, they had Mechamta Shel Torah, they argue with each other in Torah. Amarle, why are we not concerned? Why would Rav Yossi not be concerned for the witness, for the murderer or the victim combining and thus disqualifying the rest of the valid witnesses? Because the verse says, Yakum Davar, Bimekaime Davar Hakasum Midabir. It says that the witnesses, the matter should be established by these witnesses, which implies bimekayeme davar, but not those who validate, those who tell over the story, who substantiate that the story took place, but not those who are involved in the story that they are testifying about. You look in Rashi, he says, Sibai krasha asan lukum kishnayim, dehainu ha'edim, avolo be'osei ha'davar. Not the what's the right word? Not for the actors in the story. Only people who witness the story can even be brought into the purview of being valid witnesses. Whereas the murderer or the victim, there's not even a havamina. There's not even an initial stage to call them witnesses. It's not that they're invalid witnesses. It's that they can't even be classified as witnesses to begin with. And therefore, they can't be grouped together with these witnesses. In fact, I guess we'll bring in some. You have to label this down with all the Dr. Seuss stuff over here now, because it's not going to be so popular. But so the question is, when it comes to an eved, you have a non-Jewish slave who sees something happen, or if you have a woman who's not a valid witness in court. So this pasuk actually is very helpful. You see, I might say, wait a minute. Let's say this murder took place, and right, it was in Times Square. Presumably, there were men and women that saw it take place. So wait a minute. If a woman who's not a valid witness in Beis Din saw a murder take place, shouldn't she combine with everybody else and then thereby disqualify the entire kant? Did anyone ever wonder that?
No.
Okay, well now we are wondering that. So the answer is it's very similar, that because it's not that women are disqualified witnesses, it's that they're not in the parsha of Edus. It's that they don't fall, there's not a havmina, they're not part of the category of giving testimony in court, similar to how the people who are involved, who are the actors in this action. So it's not that they are disqualified witnesses and thereby disqualify everyone else. It's that they're not even witnesses to begin with. So that will not be a Shabbos morning sermon topic. for those who are wondering, you see, sometimes I say what is the Shabbos morning sermon topic. I have to say also the things that are not the Shabbos morning sermon topics.
Well, they're not witnesses because they're not allowed to be witnesses.
Well, I mean, right, the same way, but it's the same way. Here's the difference. You see, someone who's a relative, right? If I'm a relative to a litigant, I am inherently a legitimate witness. It's just something external. It happens to be I'm related to the guy. Or, you know, I am intrinsically a valid witness, but I committed a certain sin, which makes me lose my credibility in court. But that's something that is added on to my status. That's not my baseline status.
But you are allowed to be a witness in the first place if you weren't a relative. A woman can't be a witness.
Exactly. Period. That's what makes it fundamentally different. That's why they won't combine to disqualify the other witnesses, because they're not even, it's not that they're a disqualified witness, it's that they're not even a witness. So I'll leave you with that inspirational thought. Okay.
I get the definite impression that circumstantial evidence is not allowed in the based in a criminal case.
Definitely not. We need like iron, it needs to be ironclad, sealed. I mean, even for like other cases, which aren't capital cases, I'm not sure how much circumstantial evidence is taken into account. We do have ideas of chazakos and stuff, but
it's interesting, and the comment about the circumstantial evidence, and then when you start to think about the structure that's been put together here, there's a certain category of people who can be witnesses, who can give testimony, and who can bear on the findings in a case, and the rest of the structure is that there are certain people that are not considered witnesses. There are people that are automatically disqualified either because of they're a party or because their credibility is assumed to be impeached by the very fact that they're related or something else. So that there's a very narrow category of evidence that the court will, the Beit Din will even consider. And that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about those few, relatively few people that could be witnesses. And then if those few witnesses, if something happens to then disqualify them, is what it sounds like.
I'm not sure if it's as limited as we're getting the impression. Meaning, essentially, all men are valid witnesses, with the exception of if I'm related to one of the litigants, or if I committed such, if I commit fraud, I'm not going to be a valid witness in a monetary case in Basin. But I assume most people who are witnesses have not committed fraud and generally are not related. And if they are related, then it's very reasonable why they can't testify in such a case, either because they love their relatives so much or because they despise them so much. It actually goes both ways.
But that goes to credibility. And so the court has weeded out certain categories of people, either by their relationship or by their past practices, to say, we can't accept you as a witness because you're not credible.
Yeah. I mean, a family member is categorically rejected. That's just I think it's actually from a drasha. I'm not remembering the source offhand. But I don't think that was just based in making that decision. Okay, but your point's well taken that, yes, there is a certain bar for being a legitimate witness in Beis Din. That is true. There are certain qualifications. Okay, so let's move on to the next section. This really focused on opinion number one in the Mishnah, which is Rabbi Yossi, who didn't really give us many criteria for determining how to combine witnesses. And that's how we got into this whole mess of, well, if everybody combines, then, just bring in all the disqualified people. Now everyone becomes disqualified. You know, it'd be very hard to ever have a valid cot of witnesses in court. But now we're going to move on to the second opinion of the Mishnah, which is Rebbe. Rebbe, who said that this rule of one being disqualified, everyone's disqualified, applies to regular monetary financial cases, but it's much harder to be considered one group of witnesses. You need to actively show intent to be part of the same group. One way to show intent is giving hasra together, but coming into Beis Din together as the same group, Tosos talks about how that might also be somewhat of an indication. But let's jump into that right now. So moving on, two lines up from the wide lines, Amar Rabbi Yossi b'medvar Amurim, etc., Mai Asa Shniachim, etc. Okay, Heiki Arminel Hu. So here's the thing. The only way we know that the witnesses gave Hasra, they gave the warning together, we have to actually ask them, did you give Hasra together? Because otherwise, we would need witnesses on the witnesses to tell us how they viewed the testimony. Did they give Hasra together? So we got to actually, this is a little bit of the cross-examination, I think, that you were asking about earlier. I'm not sure if it's the cross-examination you have in mind, but we do ask them, again, some preliminary questions. Here's an example. Hey, Charmin Lehu, Amarava. Hey, Charmin Lehu, this is what we ask them. Limichsi asisu, olasude asisu. Did you come to view what was going on? I mean, you saw a whole commotion in the street. Did you go outside was your intention just to watch whatever is going down? You know, you're driving down on the Van Wyck, and there's a crash over there. So if you pull over and you want to see what's going on, did you come to just because you were wanted, you know, you didn't have enough excitement in your life, you wanted to see a fight going on, you wanted to see a crash going on, or la su di asisu, were you there with the intention of then later coming to testify on that case? So I amri la su de asu. So if they all said that we came as witnesses, then nimsa echlein karav apostle edusam betela. Then if one of them is invalidated, they're all invalidated because they're one group. I amri la michsi asu. If they say we only came to watch what was going on, then that's absurd. It can't just be that by virtue of me seeing something, I'm going to disqualify all the other valid witnesses who are there. Otherwise, a brother sees his brother murdered. What? So now everyone's invalidated? Now they can't get justice? So here's the thing, though. Let me ask you a question. I'll put this to you guys. Who are they asking? Are they asking the disqualified witness what his intentions were? Did you intend to testify along with the rest of these valid witnesses? Or are they asking the valid witnesses, did you intend to testify with this guy, the disqualified witness? What do you think?
Wouldn't they be asking both?
I was going to say also both.
Right. But here's the thing, though, right? Because let's say it has to be contingent. We have to believe essentially one of them we're going to rely on in the end of the day. So here's the issue. Tosus brings this up, is that if we ask the disqualified witness, and let's say the disqualified witness, right? Let's say this brother, this relative, he had a vendetta against the relative that was killed. In fact, who knows? Maybe he's even setting up this entire case altogether. And he deliberately wants to be part of the same cot. He wants to be part of the same group as the valid witnesses. Why? So then he could, you know, insert his virus and disqualify everybody. You know, imagine he hires the hitman. The hitman kills his relative who he despises. And then he said, oh no, my relative was just killed. He was just murdered. Oh man, you know what? I'm going to come with you guys to Basin and we're going to testify against that guy. Full well knowing that he would disqualify everybody else. So the issue is that Basin makes the determination of whether they're one group or not based on what the invalid witness says. The invalid witness could deliberately jeopardize the validity of the other witnesses in that group. So rather, Tosa says that we ask Damrina le Adim Kisherim Lasude Imhapsul Nasisu Olamirsi Asisu below Hapsulin. Did you intend to testify along with the invalid witness, or do you not intend to be part of the same cot as him? Otherwise, you can run into very absurd cases with conspiracies like we just described. Okay, so that's one Tosos over there. It's Tosos Dibor HaMaskel Las Hudei Asisu. We're not going to go through that whole thing inside, but it's there for you to look at. Okay. Now, well, you know, let's just get to the end of the Amud, and then I have a few things to share. So let's get to the end of the Amud. So how do we paskin? Right? Imagine I ask you, you know, how are we passing this mission? We have a machlokas. We have an argument between two Tanayim. So, okay, how do we paskin? Well, we don't really get that much closer, but Itmar, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, Halacha Rav Yossi. Rav Yehuda, name of Shmuel, says we paskin like Rav Yossi. Rav Nachman Omer, Halacha Karevi. Rav Nachman Omer says we paskin like Rebbe. So it's a machlokas even, how we paskin this machlokas. But I think the Mefarshim point out that we paskin like Rav Nachman. I think in Tosos it mentions that. And, you know, you go through the Rishonim and you go through the Rif and you go through all the Rush, the relevant Rishonim. I think many of them point out we paskin like Rav Nachman, but I'll have to look that up. Okay. So let me just pause 1 second if there are any other questions, but then I have a Tosos that I want to go through with all of us. Okay, great. I hope this is clear so far. So I welcome you, if you are able to look inside with me. And if not, I will explain it outside. So for those who have the Tzur Zadaf, the standard Gemara page with them, we're going to look through a Tosos. So Tosos Nirba Yatzil. It's kind of in the middle of the page. there, it's all bolded words, so you'll find it easily if you're looking in there. Nirba Yatsil. So here's a question. Remember we brought up the case, we asked, we said that in a case where a man sodomizes another man, we said that, oh, if the victim of the sodomy sees it happening to himself, he would not be a valid witness against the person who sodomized him. So now the question is, why would he be an invalid witness? Shouldn't he be able to testify against this guy? So I would have thought to say, let's look in Tosos, Mipnei Shu Sone Shel Rovo Bal Onso, because he was sodomized against his will, and he's a Sone. He despises the person who did it to him. He's naturally biased against him. That's what one would think, and that's how we explained the Gemara initially, right? However, Tosos quotes the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which says, V'lo nira tamuchach perakama de Sanhedrin, de nirba la'anso kasher le'edus. Actually, the Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us that a person who was sodomized against his will, he actually is able to testify against the sodomizer. So, if that is true, why is it that in our case of the Gemara, we assume that the victim is not able to testify against the person who assaulted him? So rather, Tosos changes our assumption of the case. What's the case that we assume that this person would not be able, the victim would not be able to testify against the assailant? B'yeshel yashev d'benirba l'ritzono parach d'bahachi ayri kra d'chsiv u'mesiv gam shein d'ayin b'ratzom l'hachi parach yatzal nirba afil yesh edem harbe b'dover v'lo mibnesha sono kivan shul ritzono ella mibnesha hu karov la'atzmo. And well, there's a different text here. Rather, what is this a case of? Ploni Rivoni Lurizzoni. It's got a nice rhyme to it, right? A nice ring to it. Ploni Rivoni Lurizzoni. Unfortunately, the meaning is actually very terrible. It means that he did not sodomize me against my will, but I entered into this action with him willingly. So in a case where somebody admits to willingly, the person willingly engage in this act of sodomy with the other person, then if you look in the Hagosa Siyun and they correct the text over here, he's a Rasha Upasala Edus. Why is it that this person, why is it the, well, it's not really the victim anymore per se, he's consenting actually. So why is it that he can't testify against the person who's playing the, I guess we call it the male role in this act of sodomy? Because he is a Rasha. He has a status of a sinner, and a person who commits a sin, who is actively, willingly committing the sin, he is not able to testify in Beis Din against this person because he loses his validity in Beis Din for committing this act. Because essentially, and we're going to get to this soon, if someone commits, someone is known to not keep the laws of Arayos, to keep sexual morality of the Torah, then you can't testify in a case that revolves around sexual morality in Beis Din. You lose your credibility naturally. The same way if you commit fraud, you can't testify in a monetary case in Beis Din. So Kasha, however, this isn't a really acceptable explanation because the Masechet Sanhedrin Arminan, Ploni Rivoni Ritzoni, Huvach Mitzar B'Lahargo. Wait a minute. We know that even if a guy admits to willingly engaging in this act, he actually is able to join together with a witness who saw the act get done and testify against the sodomizer. So how can Tosa say the Gemara thinks that the, I don't know what the right word for it, the sodomy? Is there like a, we'll just go with that. Oh, what was that? Someone, Henry? No?
Just the victim, I suppose.
But he's not, the victim's the wrong word here because here he's willingly engaging. I mean, you can say they're both victims of doing it, but you know what I mean, right?
How about the victim recipient? Assumes
that it was against his will.
Consensual.
Here they're both actively.
Consensual.
Actively. What, Phyllis?
Consensual?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to find like a good word, like you're sodomized or we'll call him the sodomy. Okay?
The recipient.
All right. Well, okay, you know what I mean. Okay, we'll call him the sodomy. So, or we'll say the nirva, okay? That's the Aramaic word for it, nirva. the Roveya and the Nirva. So the recipient, whatever you want to call him, he actually is able, even if he admits to committing this crime, he can combine with him. So why is it that we assume that such a person would not be able to testify against the sodomizer in Beis Din? The Shlomar, the Hani Mili, ki Lekas Adusa me Alma, the Rav Luritzono, Lekas Adusa El Mehu Atzmo Va'acher, Ulekach Pagilin Dibori, the Gavi De Lo Mehemin Le, the Karv Weitzel Atzmo. Okay, so in the case of Sanhedrin, when I am able to testify along with other witnesses against the sodomizer who I willingly engage in that act with, why am I allowed to? Because we employ another, you can write this down for the terms, another important Talmudic concept. It's called Palginon Dibure. Palginon Dibure basically is we accept one part of your testimony, but we don't accept the other. We believe him insofar as the sodomizer committed an act of sodomy. But we don't believe him because he can't incriminate himself. We don't believe him to make himself into a Rasha. We don't believe that he engaged in that act willfully. Therefore, in the case of Sanhedrin, his testimony is accepted. We believe him that the sodomizer committed sodomy, but we don't believe him that he committed it willingly. We don't believe that happened. Why? Because a person can't self-incriminate himself. So we take part of the testimony. However, in the case of our Gemara, then why don't we believe him when he says, Ploni Ravoni Lurzoni, I did it willingly? Avalhacha, the Ika Adam Shinir Balurzono, Medusa Nikor Rush, Apostle Edus, Bayonot Srikle, Duso Klau. Because here we're two witnesses seeing this happen. In addition to him, there are two witnesses. And we get independently fact check this and find out that he did this willingly. And once we know, based on the testimony of two other witnesses, that he willingly committed this act, this sin with another person, then he loses his credibility in Beis Din, because the two witnesses independently established him as a Rasha, as a sinner. And once he's established as a sinner, he loses his credibility in Beis Din. In the case of Sanhedrin, we didn't know whether he was a sinner or not. The only way we knew that he committed a sin willingly is based on his own word, which we can't accept. But here we have two other witnesses who tell us he is a Rasha, he committed his act of sodomy willingly, and therefore he's an invalid witness because he's established independently as a Rasha by two witnesses. And that's why the Gemara asks the question, wait a minute, now that we know he's a Rasha and he willingly committed this act, shouldn't he disqualify all the other witnesses from testifying against the sodomizer? That is the question of the Gemara, according to Tosfos.
Well, here's another aspect. Since he did it willingly, obviously he didn't have Hasra, and so he's not qualified as a witness.
Oh, wait, one more time?
Because he did it willingly. Mm-hmm. He didn't give a warning not to do it, and therefore he's not qualified as a witness.
Oh, so you see, the thing is, you're correct, but the Hasra rule only works according to Rebbe, the second opinion of the Mishnah. This section of Gemara is according to Rebbe Yossi, that witnesses presumably automatically combine with each other just by virtue of witnessing the crime together. So your point would be well taken according to Rebbe, though. That's why this question of Gemara never comes according to Rebbe. Toby.
Rebbe, this is like getting to the basis of the crime. Why is it a crime if it's consensual? I mean, doesn't that just eradicate the fact that it's a crime? Isn't it only...
It's two men.
So that's considered criminal even if it's consensual?
It was criminal in all the original 13 states.
We don't mean criminal right in American law, but we're talking about just biblical law. Yeah, no, yeah.
I'm drawing a parallel.
Oh, okay.
He's asking why should it be criminal? And I'm saying
any of the forbidden relationships are criminal under Torah. The Arayot would be
capital punishment.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, it's capital punishment. Again, you know, something else that's not making it into the Saturday morning sermon, but that is the halacha. Okay. Now, one other idea I wanted to share with you. This is also based on other Tosas. By the way, like if we were learning this, like if this was like a yeshiva and we were learning Makos B'i and getting deep into everything, there is so much literature on this Amud over here of Gemara, so much literature from all the classic sources. And it's been hard to really pick out what to share tonight. And my head was like going dizzy just by looking at all the different options that I eventually had to like close my books when preparing and saying, okay, there's like too much. I need to just like cut it at some point over here. There's like, it's like one of those, it's, I didn't even like have to take out one of my supplementary books that I usually use. Like the Chashuke Chemed or the Nitzotze Ashas. There's just so much here already. So one other idea I want to share with you is one of my favorite ideas that I feel like I bring up a lot. I brought this up in the Chumash class on Sunday mornings many times, and I definitely brought this up in Makos, which is, let me ask a question. So when, and I think Henry, you heard this in shul, and whoever else was with us in shul that night. Here's the thing. Let's say I am being Masader Kiddushin. I am officiating at a wedding. So when I am up there at the chuppah as the rabbi officiating the wedding, I turn to the groom, and does anyone know what I say to the groom when I ask him to designate two witnesses? I say to the groom, so they're right, there's like two nice rabbis over there. By the way, it's important, actually. You have to make sure that the two witnesses who are there, who are designated to watch the Kiddushin get done at the Chuppah, keep Taharas HaMishpacha, they keep all of the, basically the sexual laws of the Torah. Otherwise, they might not be valid witnesses for what is a marital / sexual matter. So that's why actually many people, in addition to it being a huge honor, they also make sure to have two solid, reputable Talmidei Chachamim or rabbis, whatever. It doesn't have to be a rabbi per se, but that's just usually an easy way of getting someone who's hopefully keeping halacha, right?
They have to be married? They have to be married?
No.
Married?
No. Nope. Don't need to be married. Just need to keep halacha. So now,
they're not married.
Well, I'm saying if you are married, and if you're not married, then you have to, still be keeping all those laws of, not having premarital relations with people. So here is the halacha. I say to the groom as the rabbi, do you designate these two men as your witnesses? To the exclusion of all others, right? We've heard this before. Mm-hmm. Now, why do we use that formulation? Because of a ritva. The ritva asks, wait a minute. You're telling me that if everyone present is a potential witness, and according to Rabbi Yossi, they all become part of the same kaddish as witnesses just by virtue of seeing something get done. So that means at a wedding, the witnesses, the valid witnesses, and, hopefully there are relatives at that wedding too. It'd be a pretty lame wedding if there were no family members invited. I mean, Marissa and I had all these discussions about, do I invite all my second cousins and with all their kids from Brooklyn or whatever, and then that just exponentially increases the wedding. But, obviously first round cousins, Zadie. We're talking about like the second round from my father's side, not to worry. So the whole issue is that Baruch Hashem, at a regular wedding, there should hopefully be many family members there. Family members, as we've hopefully established, are not valid witnesses. So there's a lot of valid witnesses at the wedding, but there's a lot of invalid witnesses too. So the Ritva asks, shouldn't they all combine and thereby the family members there would invalidate, disqualify all of the kosher Edim that are there at the wedding? And here's the thing, by the way. The witnesses at the wedding have a unique status. You see, usually a witness, when we talk about witnesses, they're there to be magid, to tell over what they saw. I see a murder get done. I see a business transaction take place. I see it for the purpose of later testifying in Beis Din. Whereas witnesses for a wedding, for a kiddushin, are there to be mikayim. They're there as edekiyim. Without two witnesses, two valid witnesses to witness a kiddushin, the kiddushin does not take effect halachically. There is no chalos kiddushin. He could give her the ring 100 times over. They are not married until there are two valid witnesses to see that act get done. So the issue is, wait a minute. You're telling me that if we don't have a valid cot of witnesses witnessing this marriage take place, they're not married? What? So then what are we supposed to do? Therefore, the RIFA suggests you have to actually designate two witnesses to the exclusion of everyone else there at the wedding, that these two guys are a separate group of witnesses. They don't know anyone else at the wedding. They got nothing to do with them. They just came for the shmorg and to see the chuppah get done, and that's it. They're not socializing with anybody else over there. That is their point. You know, usually the two rabbis who come out as witnesses, that's usually what they do anyway, right? So, right, they just come in for the chuppah, and then they run out. I mean, look, it's a tough job. I mean, I guess during COVID, it's easier. But, you know, if you're being invited to a wedding like every other night, you can't hang around every single night because then you have when you give your gemara share. So they come in, they see the wedding, and then they're out. So that's what happens. That's what the RIFA suggests. And there's this whole machlokas. Tosafot says, what do you mean? You don't need to do this. Why? Because what's the whole rule of witnesses becoming invalidated? When they come to court, they're invalidated to testify in court. But these witnesses, Tosafot argues in RIFA and says, they're not coming to court. They're not coming at all. What are they? They're just there to see a deed get done. They could die on the spot afterwards. And it will still be, they still would fulfill their purpose. You know, it's like one of these like Gedolim stories, one of these like, you know, art scroll stories read about, like this guy, he did this mitzvah, and then the next day he died because he fulfilled his mission on earth. I don't know if you guys like, I was raised on these kind of stories, right? So imagine you have these two witnesses, they see the Kiddushin get done, and then a moment later, their souls return to Shemayim, and that's it. They can't testify in Basin the next day, but it doesn't matter because they don't have to testify in Basin the next day because their job is to see a Kiddushin get done, to see the wedding get done, and that is it. Tosafot says there's no such thing as them becoming disqualified with everybody else because when do you get disqualified? When you come to Basin. Basin disqualifies you on the basis of being part of the same group as invalid witnesses. But if all you're doing is watching something, you can't be invalidated on that basis. So, Zog the Hele Gashari Yosher. I'll just finish this thought. Rishim Shkab comes along and says, what is the fundamental dispute between Tosos and the Ritva? According to the Ritva, even though the witnesses only have to see the action get done, when they witness the marriage get done, that is like giving their testimony in Bistin. That is their Haggadah Sa'idus as well. That's giving over their testimony. They don't have to come to Basin because that is like the Maisa Basin right there when they see the wedding get done. And that's why the rules of becoming disqualified still apply to those witnesses at the wedding. Whereas Tosafot says, no, the rules for witnesses at a wedding and Gittin, they're unique. They're not there to testify in court. They're there to just see a Maisa get done, to see a D get done, and to create that chalos, to create that effect of marriage taking place. Therefore, these rules do not apply to them. That's the machlokas between Tosafot and the Ritva based on the explanation of the Sharei Yosher. Okay, we have 1 minute left, but so this is the official end to the class. Those that need to log off, I wish you a wonderful Shabbos. Pleasure learning together as always. I will hang on for a few more minutes to address any outstanding questions.
Well, I'm certainly going to testify that I saw you and Marissa get married.
Okay, but you weren't included with those other witnesses, though. Otherwise, we might have some problems.
I was there, but I won't testify.
Okay. Good, Zadie. Thank you. Toby.
Yeah, no, so just to clarify, so you've got the two witnesses who were kosher, and the marriage happens because they witnessed it to the exclusion of everybody else. But let's say if, you know, somewhere down the line, there's a charge of bigamy. And the question, you know, now there's going to be a court hearing as to whether or not he really married a second time or he didn't marry a second time. And you need, so can any of the other people who were disqualified from being aiding for the wedding, can they testify about something related to the wedding?
Oh, interesting. Right, right. So I think what we actually do is, I think in theory, well, there's two things. Number one is the ksuba operates as proof, if not mistaken. So in the absence of there being a get, but there is a ksuba, I think the ksuba might actually, by having the witnesses sign on there, serve as a certain form of proof. But let's say you lost the ksuba and there's no get either. So then, let's see. So then if there's a charge of bigamy,
whatever the reason is, you need to prove.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you want to, you know, maybe it's the bride and groom themselves that want to prove something about that they really got married and, you know, can any of the other people there?
They'd probably be accepted in the end. They'd probably be accepted if in Basin. What we're doing is that we just want to do everything in our power to ensure that this man and woman are married to each other. So we're choshesh, we're concerned for all of these, the rifas adas yachid, we're concerned for all of these unique and minority opinions. In order, because imagine, you don't want to go your whole life thinking you're only married according to some people, not according to the others. You know what I mean? You want it, everything to be done kedatzu chedin. That's why when we're going to sell lechametz in a few weeks, we do a million kinyanim. We do all sorts of modes of acquisition. That way we know that chametz is sold. When you have something so important, you try to do everything. So at the wedding, right, there's the giving of the ring. There's the giving of the ksuba and the tanaim, which is the shtar. There's the, and you know, that those are, help effectuate the kiddushin. And then for the chuppah, you have chuppah canopy itself. You have the yichud room. And you have all these different things in place, different ways of ensuring that they are completely married. So we really go out of our way when it comes to marriage. But I think post facto, we need to find out, are they married or are they not? I don't think we would disqualify two, random friends who are at the wedding who can give testimony on that later on.
And I grew up thinking that all you had to do, a man had to say, Hareat Mekudeshet Li, put the ring on her finger, and they were married.
That's why you come to Shir to go to Shalom. You learn all sorts of things.
It was a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah. They, the RCA just started this Find a Rabbi website thing. So apparently they're trying to get rabbis in all these different regions that aren't New York. So that way people who want to get a proper wedding done under Orthodox auspices, they at least know who to reach out to. So apparently I'm on there now. So at least God willing, when I officiate weddings, I'll make sure that's clear, Phyllis.
Yeah.
Okay. There's also an issue with the whole ring exchange. If the bride gives a ring back to the groom under the chuppah, it creates this notion. If she thinks that they're actually doing a ring exchange, it might not be a valid kiddushin either, because he gives the ring to her in exchange for her.
We didn't do that years ago. That was not a part of any wedding.
Yeah, exactly. You see it? And there's all sorts of shtick that's done now. Also what I've seen, I hope I'm not offending anyone. So what they do is include women in the wedding, which, it's a nice idea. The more people you can include, the better. The issue is, it creates a tirchut tzibura, because what happens is, so you have a man say the bracha on the shabbat, and then his wife translates it. Yeah. And then it's just like, and then, it just adds on more and on. More to the What was that?
Yeah. It goes on and on. It
goes on and on. So that's why I tell one of my favorite stories, and then I'll log off with this, is that when I went to the Limud conference, which is like this pluralistic Jewish conference, learning conference that takes place. Don't ask me why I was there. But there was an Orthodox minion, and there was an open Orthodox minion. So there's like a regular shul minion like we have, and there's a partnership minion, which they have women lead some of the prayers. So at the regular Orthodox minion, there was a woman there, she gave a Dvar Torah, and when I was talking to her afterwards, she mentioned that she went to Maharat, that she's an ordained Maharat, which is the open Orthodox women's smicha thing. So I said, if you don't mind me asking, I would think you'd feel more at home at the partnership minion, which is an open Orthodox creation. Why did you come to the traditional Orthodox minion? So she said, and this is amazing, she said, you're right. Really, I would want to be there because women get more participation. But they think because women are involved in the davening, that means they have to sing every single paragraph of Kabbalah Shabbos. They have to sing every single paragraph of davening because women like singing. So it means they have to sing the entire davening now. I just want a normal davening experience. That's it. So I said, you see, I can see that you value feminism so much, but you value Kavod HaTzibur and Tirchut HaTzibura even more than that. That's a beautiful lesson right there, if anything. So
thank you.
A thought. All right. Have a great Shabbos, everyone. Yasher Koach.
I just logged in. What daf number are you on?
We just finished 6A, Vav Amid Aleph. We're going to start with 6B, Vav Amid Beis, God willing, next week.
Thank you.
Okay. Right, Shabbos, Melissa. Good Shabbos, everyone.